Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does with me, your host Bio, where we talk about what your best friends do so you don't have to. Today, I'm joined by my best friend, the director of cinema photography?
No.
Cinematography.
Director of photography.
Director of photography. There we go, we got it. Sam, how you doing, bro?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Happy to be here.
Good, yeah, good. Happy to finally get you on, my bro.
Usually I'm not in the hot seat, so it's a bit weird. It's funny.
Yeah. Bit weird? You're normally behind the lens, aren't you?
I'm usually behind the camera, yeah. I'm there.
Jeez, you know how we like to start. What did you want to be growing up, bro?
You know, funny enough, when I was in secondary school, I was sure I wanted to be an architect.
Okay.
I thought, yeah, I like drawing. I was good at drawing.
Yeah.
I was like, let me focus on that. And architecture always kind of interested me.
Yeah.
But then as I started my GCSEs, I took on media.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I failed as a GCSE. It was the only GCSE I failed.
Wow.
I failed in media.
The media wasn't media in.
It wasn't media. So I failed at that. And funny, and then I ended up doing it. I liked it. I was like, oh, I'm pissed because I failed.
Yeah.
Because I know I like it. Then I went on to do it in college, and then one thing led to another. But I feel like I was quite lucky in the sense that I knew that I wanted to do this since a young age.
Yeah.
The earlier you get into it, the better.
You wanted to be an architect. You failed at GCSE. I'm assuming you passed at college for media.
Yeah.
Okay,
of
good.
Of course. I got like both. It was a UAL sort of course.
Okay.
There was like two grades. I got A in both. So.
Okay, nice, nice. And then from there, like, how do you start to find work in the industry?
Free work.
Oh,
I had
wow.
to like, I had to work for free for a while. I think for about 2-3 years.
What?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but the thing is, that's what I mean. Like, if you're young, it's fine.
Yeah.
Because you can actually like take your time. You don't have responsibilities. I mean, as much as when you're grown. So you can actually afford to not get paid for what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started reaching out, saying everyone in need an assistance or work experience. And then, to be honest, at the beginning, I didn't know that I wanted to be a director of photography.
Okay.
I just wanted to go into it. You have to go into it with an open mind and learn as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So I started working on productions when I was like 16.
Wow.
15, but that's not like legal. But anyway, yeah. Like 16. And I just worked for free, was doing work experience. And then from that, you build connections and you have to behave, you know, do your job, do it properly, be willing to learn, and then people will call you back. And then within that, I grew.
Mm-hmm. And just on that, like, obviously when you're doing work experience, you don't do work experience as like a director of photography, right? So am I right in thinking that you'd be like a showrunner when you're on?
Yeah,
most times
a runner. Runner is the baseline, is where people usually start.
And what does that involve, being a runner?
You know, the classic, like making coffees.
Yeah,
yeah, that's the
thing. Okay.
That's literally it. Yeah, so like organizing maybe lunchtime for the crew and the cast, and if anyone needs anything, like go get it. Basically be a runner, like do things that other people don't have time to do, and just assist every member of the team, whether it's a grip, a gaffer, or whatever. Yeah.
And then how did you come to learn that photography or being a director of photography is where you wanted to land? What actually is a director of photography?
Okay, so let me start from the base. After I finished college, I was conflicted on whether I should go to uni or not.
Yeah.
Before I finished college, I started working as creative producer for that started as a work experience for a networking company, and then moved on to be a creative director quite early on.
Mm-hmm.
So then I dropped out of uni twice. Long story short.
Wow.
Twice. Yeah, I tried twice.
Okay.
Were you doing
cinematography? Film. You were doing film, yeah?
Yeah, okay, so I was doing film studies at Ravensbourne and then moved into LSBU and then dropped out of that as well.
Okay.
And both of the times I didn't finish because I was actually already working in the industry.
Yeah.
And I didn't have time, so I wasn't attending classes. So
you have to pay student loan back?
Yeah, of course.
That's so
so tap, man. I still have to do it, of course, yeah, because I actually obviously took it on.
I took some classes, yeah.
I did it for a year each university. And then I didn't have time, so I wasn't attending lessons, and they were like, what's the point of you coming in?
Okay.
So I was like, yeah, fair enough. Mm-hmm. See you later.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started working in the camera department, and then I realized that I'm actually very passionate about what the image actually looks like more than the director role, which a lot of people tend to go down. Mm-hmm. Everyone's excited, like, yeah, I want to be a director. I want to make sure the image looks good. I like all the technical aspects of cameras and lighting. So I knew that that's the route that I wanted to go down.
Okay. That's crazy, bro. And you mentioned that, yeah, like you did some running and then you've worked for an agency. Are you able to talk about some of the projects that you've kind of worked on?
You mean from both ends?
Yeah, I mean, from the jump. So
with this agency, it wasn't extremely creative.
Okay.
It was quite corporate. So this agency was responsible for directing and introducing kids in school, mm-hmm. to your job opportunities. So it was a networking company, and I was responsible for the visual aspect of it. We were collaborating with all of these different companies from different industries to create visual content to share on different platforms,
okay.
in order to educate these kids so that they actually knew what they were going into.
Yeah.
And then at 17, I started off as work experience on this documentary called Maradona. Diego Maradona.
Hey!
You know?
Really? Yeah, I've watched it.
Yeah.
He's a madman.
So I started off with that when I was, I think, around 17. Started off as work experience, and you can only keep someone for work experience on for so long.
Okay.
And I was actually doing translation. I was assisting the other editors in the team. And then they kept me on. So then I was just obviously doing day rates, stuff like that. So I stayed on that project for quite long. And then it came out in 2019. That was one of the earlier, like, big projects that I worked on. Did some work for Fashion Week a few times, and then just a few bits here and there. So, like, short films. And because I started with Azif, which is the director of, Amy, Senna, Ronaldo.
Oh, is it?
Maradona, yeah. So all those documentaries are his.
Oh, jeez.
So because I got very passionate about documentary. A lot of people start in documentary filmmaking. So that's what I kind of went down.
Mm-hmm.
From that
kick. Why do people start in documentary filmmaking?
I think it's a good place to start because there's not much you can control. It tests you as a person. It's not like... You can't plan it as much as you do in a film, so you mm-hmm. kind of just have to go with the elements.
Okay.
It builds you better.
Okay.
When it comes to whatever role you're trying to do, especially if you're a director of photography. And so, yeah, so from that came different collaborations within this agency, the networking company I was working with. I created some contests such as Itsu, so I started doing commercials for them. And within the same time with that, I was trying to pursue my career in documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
And I created collaborations with the UN in Lebanon. And I was doing documentaries down in the Middle East. And the purpose of these... I think I was 18 back then. And the purpose of these documentaries of sort was to talk about the international conflict and the issues with immigrations and stuff like that, in order to actually publish them to the different state leaders around the Middle East to bring change to these countries.
Yeah.
From a different point. It's to bring knowledge. Because obviously if you send these state leaders, so that's how they explained it. So if you send these state leaders pages and pages of stuff explaining mm-hmm. why these things need to be changed, what the problem is, they're not going to read it.
But you need to show them.
If you show them, they'll get it. So that was the plan. So they were like, oh, we need the documentary filmmaker. And I was like, yeah, go on. Okay. So then a nice relationship came from that.
Yeah.
And then I was trying to go to Libya. That's a different story. I couldn't for reasons which I can't disclose.
Yeah. Mate, you sounded like a secret agent.
No. Yeah, it was difficult. It was weird.
Double O photographer.
It was so weird. It's such a weird position to be in. And then I was like, you know what? Leave it.
Yeah.
That's fine. So then... And then, you know, I gradually got back into film and worked from the camera department up.
Okay.
What you do?
Bro, this
is... Sorry, that was so long.
That was very long-winded. So going back to my original question, how would you describe a director of photography? First question, I think we discussed it. What's the difference between director of photography and director of cinematography?
There's no such thing as director of cinematography.
There's no such thing?
Yes, cinematographer, director of photography, it goes hand in hand.
Okay, so they're the same thing, but it's cinematographer or director of photography.
Same.
It's
potato, yeah. Depends how people want to explain it, because that's the misunderstanding. A lot of people say director of photography takes photos.
Okay.
It would be stupid of me to say that it has nothing to do with photography. It does.
Mm-hmm.
but it's not a photography based role.
Okay.
What a director of photography does, he's
they this 2023.
Sorry,
we gotta be woke.
Sorry.
We gotta be woke.
I was talking from my
I hear you.
Anyway, what they do is they are responsible for the final look of the image. So they have to work with the camera department, the costume department, the set designers and the lighting department in order to actually bring the director's vision into an actual image.
Yeah.
So they're responsible for every aspect that goes into that. So it's a big role because you need to have knowledge in all those sectors in order to actually do your job properly.
100%.
Because if you lack simple knowledge, even in one of the departments, you might not know how to come across a certain problem, or you might not know how to light a certain scene when it comes to like pre-production, and you have to work with the gaffer to tell them how you want this to look. So that's basically what director of photography does.
And then based on what you've just said, yeah, how do you work collaboratively with the director and other members of the film crew to ensure the visual storytelling aligns with the overall creative vision?
Your communication skills have to be
A1.
Top notch, yeah. So you work all the way from pre-production to post-production. In pre-production, there's a lot of discussions with the director on what they want. You know, you have a read through the script, you understand what kind of mood, what kind of genre, what kind of look they're going to this film. You discuss with them what you need to actually achieve that. Once you've spoken with the director, created a storyboard, like put down the visual aspect of the film on paper.
So the director of photography will do the storyboard, or will they be like
they
part?
Do it together. So you do like you get a storyboard artist,
okay,
and then you have the director of photography and the director. They talk together on how it's going to look, and
okay,
then you basically describe those images, you write those images, you draw them, and then you get to work with the gaffer and
lighting
design and set design. Yeah, lighting.
Sorry, no, industry. Like, I'm learning.
So you work with them. You work with the grips. Grips are people who deal with dollies. You know.
Yeah, I know them things.
Yeah, things like that, and you work with them to trying to explain or to talk through how to achieve this certain look.
Okay.
So what kind of lenses are you going to use? What kind of lights are you going to use? How many of them? That also comes with a recce.
Okay.
Recce is going to view a location so you know what you're working with.
Reconnaissance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeez, there we go. Come on. Modern warfare.
Yeah. That's where it comes from. Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, I never actually. Yeah, yeah.
That's how I learned it. You know,
that's how you link. That's how you know.
When I'm doing up mission on terminal.
Yeah. That's how you have to do it. But yeah, so on a recce, you go, you check the location. Say it's a warehouse, a church, or whatnot. A lot of times, especially in a place like the UK where the weather changes like every 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what you're going to find. Like, we have applications which actually tell us what the sun's going to be and what the weather's going to be like, but you can never be certain. So a lot of times, DOPs choose to...
OP?
DOPs.
DOP. Oh, okay. Sorry.
DP, cinematographer.
Sorry. Go.
They look at what... A lot of them choose to use the natural light to their advantage. If it's a source they can control. If they can't control it, they want to replicate it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they black it out, or they completely like they use different materials to make sure that wherever the light's coming from is blocked, and then recreate that light with different lighting techniques.
I've got such a massive question here. So the fact that you've talked about how they either use natural light or artificial light or darkness. One thing I've always wondered, you know, scenes where there's rain.
Yeah, there's actual.
Is it real,
like,
or is it artificial? Do they plan for there to be rain, or is it?
It depends on the budget.
Okay, depends on the budget.
Yeah,
so you can get artificial rain.
You can, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So there's like it's sprinklers.
Okay. Oh, so, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Mad thing.
Yeah. So
magic trick.
It's basically sprinklers. So like you, like people will rig them up. So people in that department will rig them up above the scene, under wherever it's easy to like to put it, and then they just. They sprinkle rain onto the scene.
That makes so much sense. Sprinklers. Because sometimes though, you see these scenes like, you know, they're outside and they run to each other in the rain. And
yeah,
like,
it's sprinklers.
It's
man.
Just sprinklers.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh,
I think
my God.
When you actually delve into, when you when you look at it from a perspective of someone that's not in the field and you watch a movie, like, oh, nice. Being in the industry ruins it for you.
I can imagine.
Because, like, you look at all the scenes and you're like, yeah, that's how they did it. Yeah. Or, like, that's fake. Yeah, or, like, you know the simple trick of, like, frying bacon sounds like rain, so you record frying bacon because it sounds like that.
No, I didn't know that. What the
and
hell?
You recreate that
frying
sound.
Bacon sounds like rain. Yeah. I'm gonna go try that.
Yeah,
I'm
try it.
Listen out. Do you know what's so funny is that, yeah, I always think about, like, actors, and to be like an actor is very hard because when they're like doing the scene,
yeah,
there's none of the background music and stuff that gives it the oomph. Do you know what I mean?
Sometimes it's awkward,
it must
man.
Be, I must think, like, when you're actually doing the scene, it must be hella awkward because there's bare people watching you.
Yeah.
You ain't got the music. You ain't got this. You ain't got that. So, like, I was like, yeah, maybe shit, I can't do that, you know?
Because it's weird. Because obviously, like, you're in, like, especially if you're working on films like Avengers, right?
Where there's bare special effects.
Where there's, like, practically none of the scene is real. Maybe, yeah, like, water or, like, part of a building, and then you recreate that with a blue or green screen at the back, and you've got cables, you know, you're launching yourself. It's funny. It's weird. It's awkward.
Yeah.
Because then, like, if you mess up a scene, you can't keep it serious. And also, you have to obviously visualize what's going to be in front of you.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's so mad. All right. That has all made sense. Talk me through, like, a typical day on set or a typical week.
I guess no 2 days are the same, really.
Like, we love it. We love it.
Yeah, because, like, you could be on any sort of location. You could be working, as I said, you know, when I was in the Middle East, it was absolutely boiling and there's, like,
just trying to survive.
Yeah. It's weird. So that's difficult. That tests you because you're like, you need to be able to adapt yourself to all kinds of situations. If you're working on a controlled set on a movie, it's pretty okay. Like, you have tents, you know, you go onto set, you get your coffee, you usually get there really early.
Mm-hmm.
A misconception is that you go on set and start shooting there, so, like, it takes ages to set up a scene. Like, it probably takes, 10 minutes to record something and 2 hours to prep for that.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So, like, you go on there, you know, you make sure everything's ready for that day. You run through maybe the script, the location, what's gonna be achieved that day. You have a call sheet, which is usually filled in the day before. They send it to you with timestamps of what's gonna happen and realistic expectations of how long something should take. It always goes over.
Yeah.
There's always something. There's always problems on set and you need to know how to come up and deal with that. You get there, you go on a tent, say hi to everyone, talk to the director. The DOP and the director are usually looking at a monitor to see that the image is coming out well and that the camera operators are actually doing, like executing. Different directors of photography have different approaches. A lot of them like to be hands-on, depending on the complexity of a scene, obviously. Roger Deakins is this famous director of photography. He's very hands-on with the camera because he describes it as, you know, if it's very spontaneous, a lot of things change during the day. You're never going to, like, stick to a script, like, full on, because you might see something that you like. So he likes to be able to control the camera because it's harder to actually tell someone or be like, oh, you know, just turn it this way quickly whilst during a scene, turn it that way. And he likes to do it himself. So a lot of DOPs have different approaches.
Yeah,
they're usually looking at, I feel very strongly about lenses. They have huge impacts on how a scene looks.
So it's funny that you mentioned lenses there and having a huge impact. Can you kind of tell me more about your approach to choosing camera equipment and lenses for a project, taking into account the story, the genre, and the desired visual style?
God, that's a big question.
I know. Jack DPT, mix with me.
How do you do it? How do you come? Like, what do you prompt in the chat GPT to that?
I can't be giving away my secrets.
That's a massive conversation, you know.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, because obviously you can't, like, the lens has a lot to do with what you're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we're shooting this podcast with a lens that's all the way over there. It's quite zoomed in.
Yep.
It's not very personal. It's a single lens. You're quite far. When you're shooting an interview, we don't have the luxury of the space.
Yeah.
But, right, if you're shooting a scene where you want to create tension and there's two characters and then there's something happening far in the back, you use a telephoto lens.
Okay.
Because it makes the subjects or what's happening in the background look much closer to what's in the foreground.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of getting it. Yeah.
So it makes it so that creates tension. Let's say there's, like, you know, there's two men standing and there's, like, a plane, but in real life is far, far back. Yeah. From a telephoto lens, it looks really close. That yeah. creates tension.
Yeah, yeah, I get you.
Same as that, you know.
So, like, when they're at airports, maybe, yeah. and there's, like, a plane behind yeah. them, like, you know, a Top like, Gun scene or something
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know that yeah. nostalgic scene, maybe someone's saying bye-bye to someone and there's, like, a plane and it... Sorry. They want to make it look very close.
Yeah, 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 I'm with you.
They use a telephoto lens, okay? Same with wide lens. You can make a subject look small in a certain scene or location if you want to make, like, if you want to convey the fact that they're lonely.
Mm-hmm.
50 millimeters is what resembles what the eye sees the most.
Okay.
So 50 millimeter lenses usually open up to around a 40 degree angle on the scene. And it's what is most similar to what me and you see.
Okay.
So our eyes are closest to a 50 millimeter lens. So that's like the specific look that you want.
I'm going to call it the point of view look. Okay.
So it's, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's not, yeah. I hope I not butchered it.
Well, different, but you know.
So my question is, you've spoken about all these lenses
yeah.
and how they're all supposed to like portray different kind of outlooks or different distances and different outcomes. How does one come to learn about how all of these lenses portray these different stories?
Hustle, man.
Just hustle.
It's muscle practice. You just got to be on set and learn. To be fair, nowadays you can learn it anywhere.
Yeah.
But, you know...
So for you, were you learning on set like by asking other DOPs? Like, or like, did you Google YouTube?
Well, a mixture of both, really. Okay. Like, because... Depending on what kind of scale you work, there's mm-hmm. different choices depending on the budget.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of big budget sets use prime lenses. So to explain it in simple terms, prime lenses are lenses that you can't change the focal length.
Okay. I thought they were lenses that come next day.
No, what? But Amazon Prime. Hey, shut up, man.
I'm here a week. No, I'm joking.
No, but yeah. So for example, that... Yeah. That's a zoom lens.
Okay.
Right. So you can change the focal length. You can go from like 18 to 35.
Okay.
Whereas prime lenses, they're one focal length.
Yeah.
So if you want to go further from an image or closer, you physically have to move closer.
Okay.
Or further away. Prime lenses are generally better because they're sharper. They have less glass.
Because
mm-hmm. if with a zoom lens, you have to put more glass in the actual lens in order to achieve that.
Okay.
Whereas with a prime, you don't.
Okay.
So you get better looking images.
Okay.
Debatably. What was your question? How do you learn? Depending on the set you're in, just be inquisitive on what lenses they're using, why they're using it, what kind of look they're trying to achieve, and how does that link to the scene that they're shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, like if you are interested, get a camera, rent some lenses out. You can rent lenses out for cheap and test them out. That's what I did.
You can rent lenses out for cheap.
Well, yeah, so like...
I'm just thinking, if you drop it, because I'm clumsy. Like,
there's prime lenses nowadays that are very affordable.
And when we say very affordable, what does very affordable mean?
I don't know, like set maybe is like £100-200 a day.
Okay.
Which is it's affordable. Considering that people don't understand how expensive this industry is.
Yeah.
Like that camera there is 15 grand.
We can't... move the camera to show you, so you're just gonna have to use your imagination.
Yeah,
but just know that I'm coming through clean.
Yeah.
That costs 15 bucks to come through this clean.
It's expensive, man. Yeah, like all these lights and stuff, even these microphones, everything's expensive.
Yeah.
But you can rent things out for cheap, try them, get your camera, go out and test with your friends and stuff. That's what I did at the start. I just called a couple of mates and I was like, do you want to go shoot something? I got these lenses.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, yeah, sure. And then you learn how to work with them.
Mm-hmm.
With bigger cameras, you obviously need a crew because there's different components to it. You have someone that handles the camera, and you have the first AC that usually like pulls focus.
Yeah.
There's different kinds of...
I get that. My follow-up question to that, so...
Sorry, I talked bad.
No, I'm loving it. I don't want to like discredit what you're doing. Has like the development of the camera quality on mobile phone changed like the need for these high aspect cameras and these prime lenses, or no? Like, how good is it to film? Because you're seeing people like TikTok and all that. It all looks pretty crystal clear.
I'm not even going to shit on it. It's good.
It's good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because like it depends on one's needs. Like you're obviously not going to shoot a big budget film on a phone.
Maybe we could. No, I'm joking.
You know what though? Like, for example, Netflix.
Yeah.
Netflix has a list of approved cameras.
Okay.
They're obviously Netflix approved cameras, these all are, and they have like certain standards at which you can shoot at in order to actually publish a film on Netflix. So there are restrictions. You can't obviously shoot on a phone and then put it up on Netflix, okay, because they won't accept it.
Okay.
Because they want a certain standard of look. Answering your question, it doesn't really threaten the industry in itself. It allows more and more people to get access.
So a lower barrier.
It's a lower barrier, yeah. And like a lot of people feel threatened in a way that's like, oh, you know, everyone now could get access to a camera, blah, blah. Everyone claims they're a filmmaker, but there's a difference, mm-hmm. you know. Like, it's great that you have these amazing cameras. It's great for me as well, because like if I'm shooting quick content around, if I'm shooting quick videos and I want like, or maybe I'm going on set, I can actually get a closer look to what it's going to be like, because there's so many applications and the camera quality is good. I can visualize what a certain lens may look like.
Yeah.
So it's a step up in technology. I'm never going to shit on like technological advancements. Obviously, there are still people in the industry that prefer to shoot with film cameras.
Yeah.
So Chris Nolan recently shot with the IMAX, right? He shot
my guy
Oppenheimer,
right? Yeah.
And you know, people still like it's a unique look. The mm-hmm. same way, if you put my iPhone 14 next to that camera there, you're gonna notice the difference.
Yeah, of course.
You will. Like, it's close, but you're gonna notice the difference.
Yeah, yeah.
You notice it by the fact that phone cameras are much more digitally sharpened.
Okay.
If you notice.
What does that mean?
So they're more sharp. They're like, the edges are a bit more.
The edges are round. Okay, more defined. Okay.
It's been more digitally sharpened, whereas cameras have a bit of a softer look.
Okay.
More filmic look. And yeah, no, to answer your question, I don't think it's a threat at all. Like, it's great, yeah.
And moving on, how do you prepare for a shoot in terms of shot composition, camera movements and blocking, and what factors blocking. Influence these decisions?
Look at you, ChatGPT. The factors can be a range of things. Like, it starts from, as I said before, discussing with the director what kind of look you want to go for. Then based on that, you decide what kind of cameras and lenses. Top range cameras such as Arri's have a unique look. Mm-hmm. Arri cinema cameras, all different cameras have different kind of colors to them, and so mm-hmm. do lenses.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the look you're trying to achieve, you'll go for a certain camera. Arri is usually my choice because mm-hmm. I love the colors. I just love the quality. Mm-hmm. Certain people go with Red. Mm-hmm. Red is another camera brand. I feel like that's a bit more dark. Mm-hmm. It depends on what you're shooting. But yeah, so you talk to the director. What?
No, I'm just saying, so much techie.
That's it's bare stuff,
so
man.
So depending on the type of film will depend on the type of
camera. Yeah.
That's so wild. So you can't use the same camera for...
You can, but it
but
just,
it just won't come out the same.
Yeah,
it
like if you're being picky about it. Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Sony's, like, all these are Sony. Sony's are great. Sony Venice is probably the one that they use on sets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chris Nolan, again, back on that, he wanted something a bit more nostalgic, something a bit more back, because he used the film to convey that. It's good. It's nice. You know, it's depending on what you're trying to achieve, it's quite a battle, because mm-hmm. then you have to talk with the director and the gaffer. That's the pre-production stage. That's the first thing you do.
Mm-hmm.
You talk to them, see what kind of look they want for the movie, decide on the lens. So like, think of lenses as like brushes for paint.
Yeah.
There's no shit lens.
Yeah.
There's lenses that used to convey a set. Well, saying that, there are lenses that are quite, but yeah, like there's different lenses used to convey different things. So you have to choose that too.
Yeah.
Because a lens can kind of alternate what colors you're going to have in the end.
This is so crazy. Do you know what I keep coming back to as you're saying all this? What about like Ford film shot in 4D? Is there like a difference there?
4D.
Yeah, like
you know, there are 3D cameras.
Well, 3D, yeah, sorry. So it's like coming out of the screen and them things.
So like Avatar,
yeah.
2009 was the first film that actually used a 3D camera.
Is it?
Record the whole film.
It's 3D?
The whole film was shot in 3D.
Okay.
Yeah, weird. But I've never actually used a 3D camera.
Okay, cool.
So I can't tell you. But the least lenses you choose to work with on set,
yeah,
the easier life will be.
I hear you.
And if you're a good DOP, you can work with set, like just a few lenses to create the look you want. you want native lenses or lenses that work well with a certain type of camera, because not all cameras take certain lenses, blah, blah, there's different mounts. So you have to work within that. And then in terms of the final look, director of photography works in the color and post-production department too. So you're all free to that. And you work with the colorist and the editor to actually decide what look is supposed to be maintained and make sure that the structure of the story is actually kept the same.
What is a colorist?
So when you shoot in a log profile, you shoot flat, which means that there's, you're not going to see many colors as soon as you shoot, but it retains more information in order for you to pull those colors out
and then do
and manually change them.
Okay, I'll
in post production.
Yeah.
So it looks flat. It's very grayish when you shoot. Like you notice on
when
you shoot the podcast, and then the colorist is in charge of pulling those colors. You have more freedom when it comes in choosing the mood that you get, because you can really stretch colors as far as you can, blacks, whites, darks, and light colors, in order to actually replicate the scene or make someone feel something.
Yeah, so the way I interpret that is, you know how we take photos on our phone? Yeah. It'll be like in a normal, and then you add your own filter. It's like a colorist, it's like that, but it's shot. But it's shot specifically in the normal view, so you can apply the different
whatever
kind of
want.
Filter. Exactly. Yeah. That's just me understanding
phones,
it in my head.
With phones, like there are some cases in where phones are able to shoot log profiles, is not the greatest.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the general concept of it. And then I was gonna say something else, I completely forgot.
Bro, it's fine. The knowledge you've been giving me, it's been deep, so
yeah,
it's good.
So that's basically what it's so what I'm saying is, you know, director of photography isn't, a lot of people think that it's just about capturing beautiful images. So, you know, like these, I don't want to show it anyone obviously, but there's YouTube creators that use the word cinematic very freely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of to assume that an image just has to look good in order for you to be a good DOP. A good DOP doesn't really focus on how beautiful an image, well, obviously that comes as a result, as a byproduct of it, but the main role of a DOP is to make sure that there's consistency.
Okay.
An image doesn't just have to look good, it has to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it has to make sense to the story. It has to be in line with it. Mm-hmm. It can't just look good and then be completely off the row. And like, otherwise people just lose your interest. That's why I prefer when someone comes and says to me, the film was great, it looked like it was amazing, instead of someone saying, oh yeah, this scene, the shot looked great.
Yeah.
I take that as a, not offensively, but I'm like, I don't want you focusing on that shot. I want you to look at the whole movie as if, you know, that
one
makes
continuous
sense. That was great.
Yeah.
That was consistent throughout.
I hear that. And on that note, what would you say are like key skills to be a great director of photography?
Numerous. Communication, probably the first one.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have knowledge. So people usually start in the lighting or camera department. Probably most of the lighting. Lighting has a lot of influence.
So the gaffer department.
Yeah.
See, I'm learning.
I'm joking. Yeah.
Okay.
So like they work their way across that, then become DOPs. Anything can come up and you have to be the one that dictates the look of an image. So you have to be able to go to each department and be like, I want this looking like that specifically, or I want HMIs, I want daylights, I want RGBs, I want full LED. You need to be able, you know, I want light tubes, depending on what scene you're trying to get. You need to be able to achieve that look. And sometimes you're in situations where you have to change the approach because it's limited by the factors that influence the actual location.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to know how to approach that.
So you need to be communication A1, and you need to be agile, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And you need to be able to think on your feet.
Yeah, absolutely.
And adapt to situations.
Yeah, absolutely.
So like on that, in your opinion, and I think you've kind of touched upon it there, what is the difference between good cinematography and great cinematography, and how do you strive for excellence in your work?
Great cinematographers have found a look. So great cinematographers, I think, such as Roger Deakins again, you're able to go watch a movie and say, yeah, this was shot by him.
Yeah.
That's his cinematography.
Yeah.
Good cinematographers, I'm in no position to obviously judge anyone, but like, they still need to find their niche. Mm-hmm. They need to find their look. You know, you're still good. You know what to apply to an image. You know how to make an image look great and how to like make sure that a movie looks consistent and how that certain image conveys a feeling, blah, blah, blah. Great cinematographers know their visual style. They know what they want to achieve. They know that their look is unique, mm-hmm. and they've figured out a way to actually show that to the public.
Okay.
And people that work in the industry know how to recognize that. When I go watch a movie, I know it's shot by Roger Deakins because I can, like, it's just his look.
Yeah.
It's unique.
And on that, do you take inspiration from Roger Deakins?
A lot. Guru.
Okay.
Yeah, I've actually had a, like, there was an instance where we organized a call with him and with the university, and we got to like Zoom call him.
Wow.
And I was like, man, I was like a fucking fanger.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, can I say? Yeah, I don't remember. Just YouTube algorithms, don't kill me.
Yeah, basically. I was like a fangirl, man. But yeah, so like, or.
So you feel like, and on that, do you feel like the essence of filmmaking has kind of been lost to like CGI and special effects?
I think there's a lot of directors that think that the Hollywood industry now has washed out.
Mm-hmm.
That it's like, there's no values in it anymore. They don't value a film based on the imagery or on the like, on the feeling you're trying to give, or like pure storytelling is more like all one massive commercial.
Mm.
And I'm not hating on anything in particular.
Don't hate on Avengers, because Endgame
I was about to like, yeah, Avengers is great.
Inevitable.
It's great. It's for a certain audience. Yeah. That's what I always think. Yeah. I think,
but Avengers, that certain audience has like made it the highest grossing film of all time.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Like, it applies to a larger range. Whereas like the films I like, for example, you might not like because they're very artsy.
Yeah,
yeah. Or like my girlfriend describes them as boring. I see why.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're made for a particular kind of audience. I think Hollywood now is aiming more at the general public.
Right? Okay.
I like films like that. Have you seen The Green Book?
No, who's in it? I've not seen The Green Book. No,
watch it. Okay. I think that's essence of storytelling.
Okay.
But like that's why Korean films, I think.
Is it a Korean film,
The Green Book? No, it's not. It's Hollywood, I think.
Wait, is that the one with the black and the white guy?
Yeah, the pianist.
Yeah. That's deep.
That's
Mahershala Ali. That's his name.
Yes. Mahershala Ali.
And he's getting driven around by the white guy.
Yeah, exactly. Italian Brooklyn.
Yeah, Italian-American deep film. Guy. Deep film.
That film's lit. I love films like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To me, that's the essence of storytelling.
Okay, so what about Interstellar? Because that's my favourite film of all time.
But Interstellar
but I think
was
that's like sci-fi as well.
Interstellar was Chris Nolan too.
Yeah, so Christopher Nolan, you know, is my funny, favorite like, actor.
Probably
he's
like,
my favorite director.
Yeah, yeah. But that film was barely any CGI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's mad.
Like, he did everything on camera.
And this is why we love Chris. And do you know what I've just been reading recently?
Oh.
Apparently he signed on to do the next two James Bond.
Really?
He's doing the next
James Bond. Yeah, man, they're going to be lit.
Let's
go.
Yeah,
they're going to be sick. But that's what I mean. Like, that's, to me, that's great.
Okay.
That's probably one of his top films. 100%.
Yeah.
That and...
Yeah, The Dark Knight.
No, sorry. But yeah, that was a great movie. Or like Inception, another sick movie.
Yeah.
Movies like that he's got the knowledge to actually just recreate those things. Like, you know when he's like floating into different dimensions and he's touching like string. Yeah, that was all done in camera.
That's mad.
Yeah.
All right, we respect Chris. Yeah, but who's the DOP on that? Who's helping him to get that consistent image?
There's somebody there doing it.
That's
what I mean. It all worked cohesively, and like, you can't just choose any random DOP.
Yeah.
Like, there's projects which I would be like, yeah, don't pick me for. I'm not gonna say no. Like, I always turn down music videos. Not my jam.
Yeah.
And like, there's DOPs for different things. Like, mm-hmm. I know that I would perform on documentaries or films that are a bit more narrative based, you know. But I can't perform on things like Avengers. That's not my thing.
Yeah. So basically, align yourself with your strengths.
Yeah.
Basically.
Like, don't
just
greedy.
Take anything.
Yeah. Don't just take anything. And be like, yeah, I can do.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Like, no. Like, yeah. Play to your strengths. Know that you can do a certain things, and you'll be acclaimed for that. That's what I mean. Like, find your niche and know what you're good at, because that's what's actually going to set you apart.
Sick. Like, find your niche and everything that you've just said there. What would you say? Is the hardest or most stressful thing about being a DOP?
I think getting to be one.
Okay.
It's a long process.
Oh, right.
It's a lot. And like, the industry is very, very picky. on people claiming certain roles. Mm-hmm. A lot of people want people in the industry to have Ant, it's very toxic. They wanted to have Ant it. They wanted to have worked on massive budget things, you know, and I think that's very toxic. But I say, to be fair, like, I would combine stressful with fulfilling.
Okay.
Is working with a blank canvas. Because mm-hmm. you're like, yeah, you know, there's a myriad of ways in which this film could go and in which this film could look and different approaches. And a DOP would, like, one DOP would do it completely different to another one.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. You choose your director's photography based on what you know your film wants to look like. But, like, I think it's the pressure of knowing that a scene won't look exactly the same way as you've planned it. So, like, being able to, like, go on the spot and make changes and do things like that and be able to weigh in on an image and always have to be, like, have 20/20 vision in order to actually see that everything is working out the way you want it to be and that at the end of the project, like, everything is going to look great. Like, especially for starting DOPs, it's quite a responsibility. Because mm-hmm. then that's the stressful part. At the end, you're like, oh, wow, yeah, this looks sick. But during the project, you're like, well, I hope this
is looking like consistent. You don't know,
until the end. But that's also why you have, like, DITs on set, which, they are in the workstation to make sure that every single piece of data is transferred correctly, and they usually have an editing station too, so mm-hmm. they can adjust the colors and double check the images and make sure they all look good, just in case they have to, like, do another take on set if it didn't work well. But yeah, that's the stress of it. I think every aspect of working on set is quite stressful, but it's also very fulfilling mm-hmm. because it's a lot of work, it's a lot of long hours, to then obviously have that film being screened in a cinema. So a lot of people say, is that worth the stress? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's exactly what I tell to people that tell me that they want to start working in the film industry.
You have to make that decision.
Yeah, but you have to know you fucking want it before you go into it. You have to know that you love this to your core, because if you don't, you're gonna have a hard time.
Yeah,
because you have to know you love the entire process to actually make it through to the end.
All right, so we've talked about stress.
Yeah.
If we had to talk about the most rewarding part of being a director of photography, what would you say it is?
Having the input to actually choose what a scene is going to look like or what a whole film is going to look like.
Okay.
Is having your vision come to display. I think that is the most fulfilling things.
I want to go back to what you said before. So you mentioned you got to really want it. Would you say that in the role of DOP, there's a good work-life balance? What are the hours like? Okay. The hours are just crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. You're always there. Like, okay. you can have night shoots, you can have... That's like one thing that at the start, it didn't deter me from it, but I was like, wow, this is mad. Especially now, because, you know, I've got a girlfriend, like, I love her. I don't want to leave her for 6 months to go on set.
Yeah.
I think that's the hardest bit. That's mm-hmm. like long hours. Mm-hmm. And like, I think it's coming to terms with that decision. It's like, you have to find a balance, or you can do it later on. That's why, like, I'm stepping back into it. It's being able to, like, leave for months on end. It's a lot of, it's a patience game.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking about, you know, having 6 months on, 6 months off, in terms of, like, job consistency, like, and job security, how would you describe that in the industry? Is it easy for you now that you're in the industry to be regularly employed in work, or does it go in ups and downs?
Ups and downs, really. Because, like, you can work on commercials, which are a 2-week turnaround and mm-hmm. pretty easy going. Or you can work on sets where you're away for a while, but then you have no job for, like, I know people that work on sets that, like, work 6 months, and then the other 6 months they just live in a van on the beach.
Mm.
You know, they take it easy. So you could just, like, work hard on, make loads of money in that 6 months and then have nothing. So you have to be good at money management.
Yeah.
But I think that's the balance that I'm kind of looking for, in the sense that, you know, I can work on a set, bang it out, and then have that money be fulfilled, and then, you know, maybe the next job comes in 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or a year, but you know that you can spend some more time with your family.
Do you mind sharing, like, whether it be like an advert, or if you're working on set for 6 months, what can you typically expect to make? Is it like a day rate? Is it like a yearly salary?
Yeah, it's usually day rates.
And what do those rates range from?
There's DOPs that make £3,000 a day.
Wow.
There's DOPs that make £900 a day. And there's DOPs that make less than that.
Okay.
Commercials, you can make quite a lot of money because it's a smaller crew, it's a short time, and there's more money that companies like pump into it.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money if you do that for 6 months straight.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why I'm like, you can just afford to work for that long and then still maintain a family, which is what I'm trying.
And these people out there striking, you know, Dave.
Oh yeah, that's been tough, man. God, but Dave, they've come to a decision now.
Yeah, they have. Then they're gonna,
which I'm happy about, because to be honest, like, they're completely right.
How has the striking impacted your work? Has it impacted your work at all?
It has.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really hard to carry on with productions. Yeah. Well, like, to be fair, it's a fair point, and we don't want to either, because
just to give like an overview on what's been happening.
Yeah. So like, it's about pay, and you know, I say all these figures in terms of how much people make and stuff, but like realistically, for a long period in your career, you're probably not going to make that money.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be willing to like put the hours in, and a lot of times, especially writers, they do get underpaid.
Mm-hmm.
And with the implementing of AI, it's cutting out a lot of jobs, which, you know, a lot of people say you shouldn't be threatened by AI, but writers should, because it's, you know, now AI can write a movie script for you.
That's
so anyone can do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's
AI about be helping banning with these questions.
Yeah, like, it's hard, man. They need to make a living.
Yeah.
And writers have become writers because it's what they're passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unfair. It's unfair for them. And I think they've got a pretty good another deal, apparently. I don't think they've put out the details of it yet, but yeah.
And talking about like pay and everything, do you feel like in your role, you're fairly compensated for what you do?
For a while now, as you may know, I've worked for a company full on as a DOP.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very difficult. I'm being very careful of what I'm
saying. Yeah.
It's very difficult for people outside of this industry to understand how much money and time you put into it and what that's worth.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't understand, so it's about explaining to them, but a lot of times it happens to be underpaid.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, yeah, I feel appropriately compensated. It could be more.
Mm-hmm.
Could be more consistent too. Mm-hmm. But that's the like constant.
That's the life.
Yeah, that's the life.
You gotta do it because you love it.
You gotta grind it.
So we've spoken about the fact that you know, you gotta be all in it. How do you deal with like stress and, like you said, the fact that you can be away from your partner for long periods of time? Do you have any like mechanisms? Like, I've had people on the podcast previously who've spoken about ways to like potentially deal with burnout. Do you have any advice for the listener?
I got burnt out a few weeks ago. I had to take some time off, honestly, if I have to be honest, because yeah. I was finished. But
so taking time.
Take time for yourself. When you're at home, just disconnect from work. Mm-hmm. Like, my partner doesn't work in the industry, which is good, because then I get to like unplug.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love what I do, and it started as a passion, and now I can confidently say that I make money from it, which is anyone's dream, isn't it? So I never want to stop doing it, because it's what I love. But yes, it can get stressful, so just finding time for your partner, because you know, you don't want to give that up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, essentially that's what you want. I don't want to die working.
Mm.
I want to live my life and have a fulfilled life and be happy with who I'm with. So I think, and also like a strong relationship helps.
Mm.
You know, if you have a strong relationship and
somebody that you can
like,
lean on.
Yeah, because like I explained it at the start, that this is what I do. And when you have a person that's so understanding by your side, it's everything you want, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm extremely happy.
And how do you unwind? So you've mentioned spending time with your missus. Anything you do in particular?
No. I was gonna say, well, baby, what are you asking, bro?
Little wine.
Yeah, man. Something easy. What, like guilty pleasures and shit?
Yeah, like, so we've had people on the podcast who say they like to spend time with friends. They like to consume a bottle of wine. You just spend time with your girlfriend.
I spend time with my girlfriend, my dog, my cat, you know, my zoo.
That's it. Yeah.
That's why.
Part-time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. My girlfriend's always like, get a hobby. And I'm like, man, I like what I do, man. Okay. This is my thing.
Yeah.
And if I have to be honest with you, one thing that nobody knows is that I love working with wood. That sounds bad. No.
Pause.
I love, what's the word in English?
Woodwork.
I like woodwork.
Okay.
Yes, I do. That sounded
carpentry, maybe. But anyway.
So. That sounded so tapped. But I like making stuff out of wood.
Okay.
And I wish I had a bigger space to do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my... that's,
bro, thank you for sharing. Damn. Bro, this has been such a good conversation. Just last few questions before we get into the quick fire.
It's been an hour already.
Bro, it has.
Well, I felt like 10 minutes.
Bro, time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, my first question is, where do you see yourself in the next 5 or 10 years, bro?
I'm in a battle with myself at the moment. So I would love in 5-10 years down that period to be working on big sets as a DOP, have my name on screens, have won awards. Not that it matters, but like it's
a nice validation.
It's a nice validation. So like be in a position where I can win awards for being a DOP, working on sets that I like, and on, you know, large, massive budget films.
What would be your dream set to work on? Let's speak it, manifest it.
I want to work with Tarantino.
Okay, but I don't know if he's doing any more films.
No, he's not, man. I'm vexed. Where's all these new directors?
So if there's one film in the past that you wish you'd worked on, what would it be?
Goodfellas.
Okay. There we go.
I love a bit of Scorsese, man.
Yeah, Martin Scorsese. Yeah, did. Man. Scorsese did The Departed, right?
Yeah, legend.
The Departed.
Such a legend. Yeah, so that's where I want to... And like I'm fluctuating between that. And I've always wanted to have my own production studio.
Okay.
So I think maybe that'll just come down the line. Once I feel extremely fulfilled as a director of photography, my dream is to open the biggest production studio in Europe.
And then when you do that, produce this podcast free of charge, please.
And
free of charge.
Family, bro. You're in.
No, Sam, this has been sick. And like for anybody who's looking to get started in the industry, what would your advice be to them?
Humble up. Go get some free jobs, reach out to people and make sure you maintain those connections nice and sweet because you want callbacks.
All right. And then final thing, like in terms of resources to help people get started, is there anything that comes to mind? Any websites?
Well, there's a lot of programs offered. So I took part in a program with the BFI. There's programs offered by BAFTA. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of programs, especially London, because London is a massive hub for filmmakers, mm-hmm. which can teach you more about what you want to go down. There's things that are more generic to teach you about all of the sectors, and there's things that are more niche once mm-hmm. you've actually found out what you want to do. University is another topic. It's like it's a safe bubble and it's not for everyone, but it's good if you want to go there and learn different things about your industry so that you can actually narrow down on what you want to do when you get out. Working on sets, man, like I think just join these filmmaker group chats and get some free roles, offer yourself as a runner. And yeah, network through the BFI, as I said, they got a massive. It's like I'm plugging them, but
bro,
like
that's
where I began. Like I started off in a like BFI residential course, and like
and BFI that, stands for British Film Institute. For anybody wondering,
sorry for everyone outside the UK. they have great resources. That's where I began, and that's where I made all my connections. So
sick. And do you want to plug any socials? Where can people find you, bro?
Instagram, anywhere.
Yeah.
So Instagram at Baby Sam, double B, double M at the end, you know. But you can follow me on LinkedIn, Samuel Mirandi. I think that we're going to put that.
Yeah, we'll put it.
My name's Italian name. But you can find me there, YouTube, LinkedIn, the dots, all kind of socials.
All right, come on. Before we go. We do have a quick fire round.
Oh, you know what? Because I looked at the shit, I was like, oh man, these things are hard. Wait, because when I look at your podcast, because this is my favorite podcast.
Yeah, come on.
Of course.
Are you ready?
Yeah, go on.
Work from home or work from the office?
What set?
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, I was about to say, if he says home, then well, yeah, wrong. Yeah. Money or happiness?
Happiness.
Okay. Favorite day of the week?
Friday.
Yeah, good. Time in a group or time alone?
Alone. Okay.
It's funny if you're on a set with all these people.
Yeah.
Would you rather travel to the past or to the future?
Future, there's nothing, there's nothing, nah.
Nothing for nobody in the past, is there?
There's nothing for nobody.
Nothing for no one.
Yeah.
Favorite book?
The Art of Not Giving a F.
I'm not giving a fuck. Oh my god, I was thinking that for
you. That is, yeah.
Mark Manson. Mark Manson is hard. I'm not giving a fuck. Good book. Read it. Night out or night in?
In.
Who has it easier, men or women?
Men, but no one this day and age.
Yeah, okay, I hear that. Yeah. Name a book you think everyone should read.
I think that one.
I'm not giving a fuck. And then final thing, are you listening to any good podcasts?
What My Best Friend Does, man. Big up. I think all the time, I think it's very, very informative.
That. Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. Yeah, I love listening to it.
Yeah.
Learning about, because a lot of times when you work in a certain sector, you're not really friends with people in different industries. And I think it's really interesting that you actually shine through that.
Yeah.
I also listen to Shits and Gigs because...
You want some Shits and Gigs?
Shits and Gigs. Man, they're jokes.
There we go.
Also the Roger Deakins podcast.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, he does it with his wife, James Deakins. She's like there.
Her name is James Deakins?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, interesting.
I think it's James.
2023 and that? Yeah, okay.
James
cool.
Deakins. I think, yeah. But they're like power couple. I love them. They talk to all kinds of people.
As you know, we do have a closing tradition on this podcast. Based on everything we've discussed today, and, you know, based on your experiences up until this point, what would your advice be to your 16-year-old self? And would you still be doing the same thing?
It wasn't long ago. I'm 23.
Yeah.
It wasn't long ago. But to my 16-year-old self, I would say, no, obviously don't believe everything people promise. And the only way to success is just work hard, man. Mm-hmm. And trust your gut, I think, is the main one. Mm-hmm. Trust your gut. And yes, I would be doing the same thing.
Come on.
There's nothing I would change this. I think this brings me so much joy and fulfillment. Yes, 100%.
Love it. Sam, this has been a wonderful episode, man. Thank you so much for coming on. We finally got you on.
Yeah, man.
Guys, if you've made it to this point in the podcast, you know, we're in season two now. Make sure you like, make sure you share, make sure you comment.
This episode two?
Bro, we can't be talking. We don't know. We don't know what episode it is. No, I'm joking. It probably is going to be episode two. But guys, look, to all the people that have been sending me messages and stuff, thank you. Just make sure you download and like and share and comment. This has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Over and out.